Hello, this is Bob Fosbury here from ESO, the European Southern Observatory. I'm doing a voice recording of an interview with Arthur Miller concerning my collaboration with Tim Otto Rott, the conceptual artist. Arthur asked me to do this on the 26th of February. I'm speaking now on the 28th of February. And I have three questions here that Arthur wrote down, and I'll attempt to go through these questions and give my answers. I'm now working part-time for the European Southern Observatory. When I started my collaboration with Tim Otto Rott in, I guess it was 2009, maybe even earlier, maybe even 2008, I was working for the European Space Agency on the Hubble Space Telescope project. Tim Otto was invited by our outreach department to be artist in residence at ESO for a couple of weeks, and I was asked to act as Tim's host. So when he arrived, we discussed our mutual interests, we discussed a number of things that we might work on, and in fact we initiated one project which we worked on until we had an opportunity because I was helping to organise a conference and exhibition in Venice on the 20 years of achievement with the Hubble Space Telescope in astronomy. And so we saw that as an opportunity actually to make an artistic installation which was related to Hubble Space Telescope in some way. So that's how it started. And the first question that Arthur asked me is, how has it affected yourself generally as a scientist? Well, let me start addressing that question by saying that when I was a kid, when I was at school, I was fairly involved in artistic pursuits. I did several O-level examinations in artistic subjects. I also worked in science, but it wasn't until I changed school at the age of 15 or 16 that I really decided to do science. But I kept an interest in art, and particularly I would say technical art, technical drawing. I kept that interest throughout my my career. I ended up doing astronomy, an interesting career, going to various places, Australia, Geneva, ESO in Munich, and so on. And, of course, most of my actual work was concerned with scientific pursuits. I always had an interest in presenting the results of this science, if necessary, which often is the case, using diagrams and so on to try and get the ideas over. And I also had an interest in public outreach. I had an interest in giving public talks. I give quite a lot of public talks now to audiences of, obviously, non-scientists. How does art come into this? I think I'd always been uncertain about visual arts. I found it difficult to go around galleries and look intelligently at visual arts, paintings, drawings, and so on. But I did make a bit of an effort, and over recent years I've certainly visited a large number of galleries and tried to understand better what was going on. That may not be very relevant to what we're talking about today, but I certainly had a sensitivity to using different channels to explain what we were doing in trying to understand the universe. In fact, life, the universe, and everything, one might say. And I was always acutely aware that art offered an opportunity to do this in some way and perhaps capture a very different audience. So I would say I was basically very sympathetic to the idea of an association in some way between art and science. And having Tim Otto Rott here for a couple of weeks and a very close contact during that time certainly gave us an opportunity to explore possible ways of doing this. Let me just mention very briefly the first idea that we had. I'd been doing public talks on the origin of the chemical elements, and we discussed a way of converting this perhaps into some art installation by using the light emitted by particular elements as a way of achieving an interesting and perhaps educational the wrong word, but an inspiring view of the fact that the elements didn't always exist. They had to be made somewhere in the universe, and they could be discovered and identified and eventually their origins understood by using a scientific approach. So we looked at this. We actually worked with some people at the Max Planck Institute for Plasma Physics next door and discussed with them the possibilities of generating glowing plasmas of different colors using different elements. But as I mentioned before, we had this opportunity to work on a topic associated with Hubble Space Telescope in Venice. So we had the idea. Now, I think it genuinely was a joint idea. I can't remember exactly how it evolved, but this was to use spectra from the Hubble Space Telescope, perhaps a courageous choice of subject matter, that is something distinct from the very beautiful colour pictures that Hubble has become renowned for. We decided to use spectra as a way of capturing the imagination of people in terms of the use of astronomical telescopes as time machines. With Hubble in particular, we had the opportunity to obtain spectra of extremely faint sources, some of which, in fact, a significant fraction of which, were extremely distant objects in the universe. That is, they were objects that we were seeing at a time when the universe was much younger than it is at the moment, perhaps even as much as 10% of the current age of the universe. So this is a fairly profound concept, the fact that with a telescope we can see things going on, actually going on, as they were going on 10, 12 billion years ago. And if we could present this in such a way that the audience of the installation could grasp the idea of seeing the distant past, which is what we called the installation in the end, from the distant past, if we could actually capture that idea and instill it in the audience, that would be a certain achievement. So that's how the process started. And it turns out to be, of course, a very intimate relationship between the basic science itself, which we had control over, because in fact we, our group in Munich, was responsible for actually working on the data from this particular mode of the Hubble Space Telescope. We had control of this, and we had therefore an open opportunity to convert this into something which could be considered an art installation. So basically after Tim left ESO, we worked closely together to get this into a form that could work as a spectacular and perhaps novel art installation. Well, the process went on, and we performed this installation in Venice, in a very spectacular location. I'm sure you've seen the movie. I think this had quite a high impact on the audience. There was a huge audience, of course. Venice in October has a lot of people. This was a very prominent position. It was during the Biennale, and so Tim got a lot of exposure during this process, and he was subsequently invited to set up this installation in Baltimore and New York, and the story I'm sure you know. The question of how it influenced my view of the relationship between science and art, I think it's contributed to my realization that whilst explaining the details of science, especially when you're using a technique like spectroscopy, which is not very familiar to the public, while doing that successfully is quite difficult. I think if you can go to the front of this effort and grasp the concept of looking at something from the distant past, bypass all the technical complexity of actually acquiring the data and interpreting it, and displaying it as something which is eye-catching, has a sort of symbolic meaning as, and Tim was very keen on this idea, a sort of heartbeat of scientific discovery. You have a very direct representation of something which is basically very interesting to think about. That is, this is light, which has travelled for 10 or 12 billion years. It's been captured by a telescope in orbit. The data has been beamed down to ground, and after some processing has appeared as a green spot being written along the wall of a palazzo on the Grand Canal in Venice. I mean, there's a lot of bypassing in detail in that process, but the idea can really catch on, I think, and it can have a lot of impact, and it does present a single scientific idea in a very powerful way. So it amplified, I think, my belief that one can inspire people with scientific ideas without necessarily educating them in technical details. You could successfully bypass those details and get people thinking about the fundamental idea. So that was good. And I think that was, for me, a very positive experience. It didn't fundamentally change my view, because I guess I was prepared to believe that already. But it was a very direct illustration of the fact that it could work, with some effort, of course, but it could work, and people could really appreciate it. Hello, this is Bob Fosby again, now on the 18th of March, recording part two of the interview. I apologise for the hiatus, but I had to go away for a while and then catch up afterwards. So the second question on your list was whether this has affected my day-to-day research. Has it affected my day-to-day research? I'm not exactly sure what you mean by this, but I think if you mean, do I have a sensitivity and an awareness of how to present my research to a broader audience as I actually do the research, then I think the answer is probably yes, it has in some way. Although, as I said in part one of the interview, I think I've been aware of this for quite some while. Now, actually, I'm retired from my original job, and I've made the decision to change my area of interest and research somewhat, not entirely out of astronomy, but you know, whereas before, most of my research concerned the edge of the universe, in a way, certainly very distant objects, I've now decided to change my perspective and look back towards the Earth as an extrasolar planet, and ponder questions of how one could learn about the Earth by looking at what radiation it's reflecting and emitting. So that's a change in perspective of my research, and it's a change which is into an area and a subject where I think there are probably more opportunities to present the results to a general audience in a more artistic way. And I think I'd like to mention one of the things that I'm doing now, which is in a way related, is to be much more active in investigating my long-held interest in natural colour of things. You know, the relevance of colour to my career of research on distant objects of the universe, of course, is quite high because spectroscopy is a tool that I used extensively. It was, you know, I guess my primary research tool over many years. While doing that in astronomy, I'd spent quite a lot of my time, if you like, as an amateur, looking at the colours of natural objects. I actually did this with a collection of visual spectroscopes, so I peered through an eyepiece and looked at spectra of an amazing array of things. In fact, you'd probably laugh if I told you some of the things I did, but anything from biology through mineralogy, rocks, gemstones, sources of light, the properties of the Earth's atmosphere, many, many things. And I kept notebooks about this for perhaps 35 years. I still have them on my shelves, and I often go back and look at things I did in the past. One thing I did after I retired, maybe slightly before I retired, in fact, with the royalties from a book that I'd written with colleagues at ESO, or a couple of books about the Hubble Space Telescope and that kind of research in astronomy, I bought myself a digital spectrometer, a very good one, something which, you know, could produce professional quality science. And over the last few years, I've been using this to record the spectra of a very broad range of objects. And I generally accompanied the spectra, which in themselves are not terribly accessible to a broad audience, as we mentioned before, I accompanied these spectra with photographs. So I produced a composite image, which consisted of a photograph or several photographs and a spectrum, and accompanied this with textual description accessible to a broader audience. And I pondered how to make this available to a broad audience. And, you know, after considering possibly making my own website or using some kind of scientific website, I decided to do this on a general photographic website, very broadly available, Flickr, run by Yahoo, which contains a huge, huge volume of photography of various qualities, but including extremely high quality photography. And in fact, at the time, I wrote to Yahoo and said, you know, do you mind if I publish plots of spectra on Flickr, because it's a photographic website? And I'm not sure they really understood what I was asking, but they said, yeah, sure, go ahead. So I started doing this a couple of years ago. And initially, as one might have expected, it generated very little interest. The number of views I got were minuscule. But gradually I picked up one or two enthusiasts who shared a common interest, and we exchanged emails and images and so on. And I must say, over the last couple of years, the broader interest of this has grown enormously. And I now get something like, on average, 200 views of my spectra a day on Flickr. It's not very clear to me exactly who's looking at this, but I do post these more scientific images on websites dedicated towards education. There's one called the Physics Classroom in the US, which makes the material available for the US physics curriculum by getting the teachers to add special keywords to the posted pictures, mine in this case, to link them to the physics curriculum in the US. And there are other websites as well for publication of general science. Now, this for me is very much an intimate combination of art and science. I mean, I'm driven by, if you like, a general curiosity about nature, which you might want to call science, you might want to call art, I'm not sure, something in between, but it's a very general curiosity about nature. But it's actually doing something about it and investigating phenomena that are visible in nature. And the object of this exercise was not necessarily to do original research, but was to educate me, basically, in what I saw. And it made me take a much more active interest in areas of science that I was not fully educated in, like biology and chemistry and so on. And so I read a lot more in these subjects. I contact people who work in these subjects, and I find that doing this, given the, you know, the experience that I have as an astronomer, as an astrophysicist, I can approach a chemist or a biologist who's at the cutting edge of their research area and perhaps contribute some small area of expertise to their research as an equal. I don't have to, work my way up the hierarchy in my new subject. I can approach these people and get directly involved in cutting-edge research in an area that I've never worked in before. It doesn't happen very often, but it certainly does happen, and I could give examples of where it's happened. And I find this very interesting personally. I also find it a very powerful indicator that in the web we have a way of doing multidisciplinary research and that we've not had available to us before, because we can post what we do in a way that can be picked up by other people using, for instance, Google searches. These Flickr images have tags and keywords associated with them, which are very directly accessed by Google. And so you can make the work that you do available to a much broader audience, in fact, than you would if you published in a dedicated journal in your subject area. And this is very interesting. And in fact, it reminds me of the situation enjoyed by Victorian vicars in Britain in the later part of the 19th century. People who had large houses to live in, had a secure income, didn't have terribly much to do, had a broad interest in many things. And many of these vicars, of course, took a powerful interest in science and communicated with one another around the world by letter, obviously, not by internet at that time. But there was a network of people who had the time and the interest to pursue many, many areas of research. I think that possibility is being reinvigorated now by the web. And the multidisciplinarity of this process, I think, includes science at one end of the spectrum and arts in the other, and it occupies the space, the very big space in between these two interests. So I'm doing this actively at the moment. I mean, most of the, although I do publish photographs on Flickr, most of what I publish these days is more scientific, and it does seem to be picked up, and I don't retain an exclusive copyright on this. I give it a Creative Commons license so people can reuse the stuff. They can post it on other websites and so on. So hopefully it does get integrated into the general level of knowledge. And, you know, it has struck me that in some of the areas that I work in doing this, it's very hard to for a non-specialist in that subject to get into the literature, because you find a reference in a journal and the journal asks you to pay $30 or 30 euros to read the article. And I find this extremely annoying. So I feel I'm snubbing my thumb at the people who are doing this by publishing my stuff openly. Okay, my stuff is not peer-reviewed stuff that would go in a scientific journal, but some of it is original. A lot of it is higher quality in terms of spectroscopy and imaging than you would find in the journals anyway. So I think it has a role, and it certainly does seem to be being picked up. And I feel a certain responsibility to make it high quality, and I in a sense measure this by looking at the comments I get from other people and responding to questions and perhaps doing further research to clarify certain points. So it's a way of open source publishing, which breaks down the barriers between subjects and also breaks down the barrier between science and art. And I find this a very stimulating area at the moment. And I might mention that one of the results of this is that through an old friend and colleague of mine who is head of physics in the University of Durham, he pointed out to me that there are fellowships at the Institute of Advanced Study in Durham which concentrate on a different topic each year. And he pointed out to me that the year 2013, the topic was light, which was kind of particularly resonant with my interests. So I made an application for one of these fellowships and got a fellowship. So I will be going to Durham for the last 3 months of the year and working with 9 or 10 other fellows who come from different areas, including science, poetry, literature, I guess politics, technology, and so on the topic of light. And I look forward to this and find it another way of mixing the subjects together and making the investigations very multidisciplinary. In fact, Tim Otto wrote a reference letter for me for this fellowship, and I'm sure that that was extremely helpful to me. So that's what I'll be doing. So I think that's probably as much as I can say about how it's affected my day-to-day research. And I think, yes, quite deeply, there's an awareness of the different ways of presenting one's knowledge of the universe. I think astronomy is particularly fortunate in this respect, in that, you know, many of the things that we do as astronomers or astrophysicists do have a very strong intrinsic interest for people in the general public and people from other areas. And so, and we do have wonderful visual products that people can enjoy. I have on the wall in my study, I have some very spectacular pictures taken by Hubble and by large ground-based telescopes, some of them processed by me, but images which are available to anyone on the planet. I mean, there's no copyright associated with these images, so they can be very, very broadly used. Okay, I'll have a pause here and then I'll move to part three. Well, now I'll come to your third and final question, how your interest in the interplay between art and science arose. Well, I think much of what I've said already addresses this particular question. So I think I'll wrap up by just mentioning one or two other things which I think are relevant, and also mentioning some books which I have found particularly pertinent to this interest and indeed have inspired me to a great extent in pursuing my interest particularly in natural colour and natural phenomena and so on. And these are books which I would not call pure scientific books. They are interdisciplinary books in that they have an eye on the art as well as the science. The first of these books is, for me, a Bible. I was introduced to it by one of my physics teachers at school, and it was really the book that, I guess, inspired me to do scientific research, or at least an attempt to put myself in a position where I could do scientific research. It's called The Nature of Light and Colour in the Open Air. It's written by, I think, originally a Flemish scientist, astronomer, called Marcel Minert. I put these references in an email to you, so you don't have to write it down from here. But this is a book about, it's one of three books that Minert wrote, actually originally in Dutch, in the 20s and 30s. It's the only one of these three books about physics in the open air. It's the only one that was actually translated into English, and it's been in print, I think, ever since the 1930s. And it's a wonderful book which describes essentially every phenomenon you could hope to see in the atmosphere concerning light and colour. In fact, I became very familiar with this book. I made observations of many of the phenomena that he discussed. And I have to admit that in the last several decades, I've only found one or two phenomena for myself which are not actually mentioned in the book. So that was one of my inspirations, and it's a wonderful book. In fact, I make sure my students read this book, because I say to them, look, if you look at the atmosphere, the Earth's atmosphere, and you can't understand the phenomena you're seeing, you have no right to be an astronomer to try and figure out what's going on at the edge of the universe. So I think it presents the basic ethic and philosophy of being an observer, which astronomers are. You have to have this curiosity. You have to be driven to understand the phenomena that you see. The second book I will mention is not so easily available, in fact, although I think it now parts of it are available on the web. It's written by C.V. Raman, of Raman Scattering fame, the first Indian Nobel laureate in physics. He got the Nobel Prize around, I can't remember the exact date now, it was 1929 or 1930, for discovering inelastic scattering of photons from molecules. He was a very curious man. Unfortunately, I never met him, although I knew his son quite well. His son was an astronomer, died only just over a year ago. Raman himself had this curiosity about science, which extended to as far as not necessarily believing what had been done by other people in the past. And he was very interested in human color vision. He didn't believe the current theories in the 30s, and so he decided to do his own investigations. And he wrote a book published by the Indian Academy of Sciences called The Physiology of Vision. And this, again, is a wonderful book. It contains all kinds of things which would delight and surprise you about the sensitivity of the eye to colour and polarisation and strength of illumination and so on. It's a beautiful book. I found that deeply inspiring. The third book is available. It was published, I think, around 2005. Got it in front of me. It's written by somebody called Peter Pesic, and it's called Sky in a Bottle. I actually read the review of this book in Nature by chance and immediately ordered it. And it's an account of the history of trying to understand the colour of the sky, why the sky is blue, its influence on primitive societies, its influence on their art and their science, and basically making the point that really understanding why the sky is blue took a very, very long time to figure out, and it was only at the end of the 19th century and through the 20th century that this phenomenon was really understood. So I think those books, there are others, of course, but I have a relatively small number of books which I consider my prime inspiring books and sources of reference. Those books had a very strong influence on my how I saw the interplay between art and science and our general awareness of nature. So I think I've spoken for long enough. I'll come to an end here. I'm certainly very happy and willing to follow up any points you'd like to bring up. I hope this is not too long and tedious to listen to. Actually, I see on my computer it's a very big file. I'll try and figure out a way of compressing it and reducing the audio quality a bit so you can actually access it. But I hope it's of some value to you, and I'm sure we'll be in touch. Bye.